Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and let me ask you something right out of the gate. Do you think it's easier to think about change or to actually take action and change? Which one do you think is easier? Because I think that a lot of people have this idea in their head that the action part is the hard part. But I think it's the other way around. I think the action part of change is the easy part, because all you got to do is do it. It's all the thinking about what's going to happen if you do or if you don't that's hard. That's where you really start to trip yourself up, is in your thoughts. Because when you act on something, you've already done it. There's not really much to do other than try to figure out what you're going to do next. But when you have some thoughts that you've got to work out, what are people going to think? What am I going to think? How am I going to feel after I make these changes? Am I going to lose people? Who's going to stay? Shit, for that matter. Now, again, I don't really know what I'm talking about all the time. These are just thoughts that I have. I'm not a licensed therapist, and this is not a replacement for real therapy if you need it. You can think about this more like finding a practical use for the toy that comes in your cereal. Like, oh, look at that. The Cocoa Puffs Pez dispenser holds my medication now. I'm not cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Thanks, Aripiprazole. Today, we have Sean DiCrescenzo on the show, and it's the first time having a musician on, and he's going to play a song for you in a little bit. And it's really touching. There was a really incredibly intimate moment in the episode where he's playing the song, and it's just me and him in a studio in a room together. And it was just chilling. There was something really eerie about it, and it all comes through. It all comes through. So you're going to hear that. Sean is in the band Decatur. He's also in the band Riches. Full disclosure, I am also in the band Decatur with Sean. I am the drums master general in that outfit. And you can check them out at DecaturRock.com. You can check Riches out at Bandcamp. But this one gets a little intense today. This one might be one of the more interesting ones to see what the fallout on this is, because I talk a little bit about my history with drugs, although I didn't really have the same history as we're going to get into with Sean. I've definitely had my ups and downs, but you know what? I'm not going to preface this. Without any further ado, here's Sean DiCrescenzo and myself having a great discussion. Here you go. So, how you doing today? Happy 4th of July.
Yo, it is a holiday.
Yeah.
Everything's going to explode.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's kind of the nature of the beast.
It's the nature of America.
Exactly. It's either dipped in cheese or about to explode.
It's two very, very, you know, it's either left or right.
If you can get both of those things in one item, if you could
exploding,
get...
Exploding fried cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like there's got to be some way to stick an M80 in a mozzarella stick. And just strap it to a bullfrog to get the trifecta.
Kids love frogs. So.
And cheese.
And cheese.
But not surprises that take off your fingers.
No. Surprises, yes.
Surprises,
fingers,
yes.
Fingers, no.
Well, agree to disagree.
That's, I was surprised. My friend, I have a friend that I work with who has severe, like, traumatic anxiety.
Brag.
So I have this friend. Name drop. It's Kanye. And so when we're at the office, we play with Nerf guns, and she has a rule where you can't shoot them at her because if she gets hit by one, she'll have, like, a breakdown, a full-on breakdown.
Yeah.
Loves fireworks.
Really?
Loves fireworks. She was like, if I saw her earlier, she's like, if I don't see some fireworks today, something went wrong. And I don't, wow. I mean, maybe she's anticipating it or like, it's just
so like the opposite of a dog.
I assumed that she would not want to be around for fireworks, but it's like the opposite of a trigger for her.
Yeah.
I guess. Well, and I mean, like I'm so familiar with the word trigger now, and it's very much like relatable with anxiety and things like that. And I feel like with her, it's just something where she doesn't associate fireworks with her anxiety. So it's totally okay for her to be like right next to something blowing up at like 400 feet per second. It's great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody has their standards.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting hit with a Nerf dart.
I love that.
Getting hit with shrapnel.
Love getting hit with shrapnel. Mostly Nerf dart shrapnel.
What are we doing?
I don't know.
All right. Well, that's fair.
Welcome to the podcast.
don't talk to them. Talk to me.
Skip this.
Don't worry. I'm going to cut all of this out.
Love it. I'm loving right. it.
Just can you dial up the so sadness a little bit?
I'm sad. If
you
can.
Yeah. You know, just channel some Lou Reed for me. I mean,
try and make it that way.
You're supposed to be a sad artist type.
I'm going
to
go monotone.
Yeah. I need you to brood a little bit here.
Depression is weird. Depression, anxiety is weird. And I'm very new to the game of it because I kind of did it to myself.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because I checked into rehab a few months ago and was in there with like a serious amphetamine problem.
Yeah.
And when I got in there, the first week or two of getting off of it was insanely difficult. And after that, I realized that a lot of it didn't go away. And I thought that after, you know, a couple of weeks where it was out of my system, I'd start to feel kind of normal again. When I was in there, it was outpatient. When I was with the counselors, they said that all of the natural receptors for, you know, dopamine and things like that in your brain kind of shut down over time when you have a prolonged prolonged exposure to things like that because you don't need it anymore. Because the same way that those, you know, those your dopamine and things like that are released in your brain and find those receptors, the amphetamine takes place of that and it confuses it into thinking it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So the things that create those just natural things kind of just turn off for a while. And depending upon how long you get it, it's called it's like a drunk sober.
A dry drunk.
A dry drunk. Yeah. They call it a dry drunk or something. Yeah. That's it. Dry drunk. It's kind of that dry drunk thing where it takes a while for everything to kind of balance out again. But I've always kind of had that. There, it just never was something that I sought to take care of.
Yeah.
Because I was very much just living through it and thinking, like, this is just what everybody goes through all the time.
Right.
Which I feel like a lot of people do that.
Oh, totally. I mean, I actually came by, I actually did sort of the reverse of what you did.
Mm-hmm.
I found out that I had a drug problem getting checked in for a mental problem.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I had a God-shaped hole in my heart. And I thought, you know, heroin could fill it.
Yep.
And
hey, yeah.
We could try that.
Familiar.
Yeah. So I did that for a little while, and thank God it didn't take. Because when I got admitted, because mine was inpatient, and when I got admitted, I started going through withdrawal, and it was like, oh,
I didn't expect
there's,
it either.
There's another problem here that I wasn't aware of, and so that was, I mean, the way that it hijacks everything, it's almost like as soon as it's out of your system, your brain is just broken. Like nothing brings you joy. Yep. Chocolate is cardboard. It's like everything has lost its color, and there's this just nasty gray layer of paint over everything in the universe.
Yeah, nothing is as good as it was.
Yeah.
Nothing feels quite the same. Everything could be better.
Yeah.
Nothing is fun to do.
Right.
In the first few months, and it's a serious struggle that I had playing with the band, was the first show that I played after I got sober, I literally had to stop before I played it and say, can you do this?
Yeah.
Like, can you do this sober? Will you still like it? I was nervous as hell. I couldn't stop shaking. I had like a pit in my stomach. And I genuinely thought, like, maybe I'm not going to want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Like, because I associated it so much with, you know, we're going to go play a show. We're going to have a great time.
Right. And what that means is.
Yeah. what that means is you have a great time.
Yeah.
but no. And the thing that you said about. So I kind of knew. I wouldn't say I knew. I started to recognize it when I couldn't keep myself from doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. It would be a thing where at first it started out as casual fun because very, you know, it's a leisure thing here. Everybody does that here.
Yeah.
It's shocking, the scene for that here. So it'd be a casual thing where I was just doing it regularly. Then I started doing it a little bit more with a certain group of people. Over time, it became a thing where I didn't recognize it was a problem because it was always casual and it would show up and I wasn't looking for it. And then it became a thing where, you know, you do it and then you'd be like, I need to keep doing this or I'm not going to be able to function. And then you know, once you hit that point, all of a sudden you're doing it 5, 6, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And the first time you try and stop after that because you realize, oh, no. You make it for about a day, and then all of a sudden, there you are,
yeah.
trying to figure out why you feel so horrible. And then at that point, I just it shook me, and I kind of sat in that for a while and didn't really know where to go. And finally, just kind of, because you know, you know, for every person who goes to rehab, there's a person who's out on the streets, like still out.
Yeah,
they call it still out, like you're out.
Yeah.
Like you can either be sober or you're out, which means you're just still in the shit.
Right, but the thing that makes it hard when you're in the middle of your personal recovery is that you see people like that. And the guy might be on the side of the road, but he's standing upright, and so you go, that guy looks like he has it together.
Yeah.
So if he can handle it, you know, surely I'm just doing it wrong.
Yeah.
And that there's got to be a right way to do this. And if I solve the Rubik's Cube, then
I had that thought on the way over cuz like, I mean, and the thing I'm sure you got this whole spiel a lot of people through the programs, you'll always find that one person in the class who genuinely by the end of it, you pull them aside and you're like, you can help people. Like you are the person you should do something. Like stick with this. Please don't go back out. Help somebody. Like you help me, you can help other people. And I was thinking about my friend who kind of was that to me and like just hoping that he was all right. But it's very much like, you know, I'm not the anti-drug advocate. Like I'm fully sober. I don't mess with anything. But I recognize that, you know, that's not a lifestyle for everybody, and it's not the right lifestyle choice for everybody. For me, it has to be because you get to a point where you realize, oh, I'm the kind of person who can't do that.
Yeah.
There's the people who can have fun with it and it's just okay, and then there's, you know, me. And I take it too far, no matter what. I'll always take it too far, and it's not a choice. It's not my own choice. I can't.
It takes over. It's a real hijack. I mean, there are certain things that I know about myself because I mean, addiction runs in my whole family, and so what I know about myself is where I can go and where I can't.
Yeah.
And the one side street that I can go down is I can drink.
Mm-hmm.
But every time I drink, I have to be conscious of it.
Oh yeah,
like the same way. I can't be a person. Uh-huh. Yeah, but I can't be a person who's left to their own devices.
Mm-hmm.
because if I don't think about it beforehand, I have all the drinks.
Absolutely.
But if I think about it beforehand, I tell myself before I even start, "You're gonna have no more than 3,
mm-hmm.
and then you're done."
And it is,
and I always do it. It's gotten hard for me to do, but as I get older, it's easier for me to maintain that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't let me believe that I can go do other things.
Yes. They say that. I mean, they say that. So when I checked into the program, I recognized that I had a problem with one thing, but not necessarily another. And the first thing they said to me is, just so you know, this is a full sobriety program. Can you make it a month? Because I was very much under the impression, I was like, I don't have a problem with drinking.
Right.
I don't. I never have. I don't like to drink that much.
Right.
But it became a thing where I recognized that I can't drink because I was only making those choices that got me into the situation I was in because I was going out and making one bad choice.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I have a few drinks, I always think, you know, it would make this better.
Yeah.
So well,
that's the issue with thinking you can partially impair your thought process when your thought process has to be the sharpest it's ever been.
Yeah.
When you have to be laser focused.
Or that DOC just comes right back at you.
Yeah, exactly.
No, yeah. It's a weird thing. And I told myself after it was about a month and a half, 2 months. The first month I would think like, no, you know, like you're gonna have a beer after this. And I was drinking non-alcoholic beer.
Yeah.
Just holding on.
Yeah, yeah.
Just trying to hold on. Yeah. Just whatever was left. And then after the first month, I kind of had a moment where I hadn't said it before, but I said that thing. I said, you know, like I would always go drink and then I'd kind of like make this decision after I had like 5 beers.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do tonight. It's going to be great. It's going to make me feel awesome. And then I was like, oh no, like that, you can't, because it's not going to go away. And it's weird how it's like a constant, it doesn't go away. It's a constant fight.
Right.
You always have to be conscious of it, because the second it comes back harder than it did before, because you've already been there. You feel like you know what you're doing, but it just comes back harder. So it's a thing that, you know, if you put yourself, I've been in those situations already in the past few months where it's like, oh no, that just came out. I gotta go.
Right. See, and that's the problem most people make with recovery, and why it fails them is because they have this idea that it's a thing that you're supposed to overcome and not a thing you're supposed to learn how to live with.
Yeah. It's very much not. Yeah. What is it called? Like, this is a very constant thing that people say is, you know, you did rehab, you're cured.
Yeah.
Like, are you like, you will get out and people will say, so did it work?
Right.
And that question is just like, I mean, maybe we'll see over the next 60 years.
Yeah.
But it's very much a thing that it's you're always in that thing. Because I still have those days where that's the thing that's on your mind. And you'll be out and like, you know, you'll have those days where, and I'm sure you get them too, where you're like, man, that would be really fun to do. Just to do it.
Yeah.
But you can't really let it creep back in, because the mental health problems that come with it kind of spiral. And it's an all-encompassing thing once you kind of get into that, and especially with harder drugs. We're in a marijuana legal state, which I've never been a fan of. Not that it's legal. I don't like it because of my personality. But like in that sense, like
yeah, I've never been a marijuana guy.
It puts me so much out of my own head.
And I like to be. I'm like you. I like to be up.
Yeah, I'm up, and I like to be in control.
Exactly. I mean,
I have a power complex.
Totally. Yeah. Absolutely. So when you're looking at stuff like that, it's like, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that drinking is not a thing that really excites you too much.
No. Yeah.
You know, drinking calms you down.
Yeah.
But what you really want to be is up and going.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's where black coffee comes in. It's like the 13th step.
It's the 13th step.
You can have as much of that as you want. Nobody can tell you you're wrong.
Steps classes, and coffee is a constant in life.
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I got the black coffee thing from my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad went into recovery when I was a kid, because he was a guy who couldn't stop either.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what I remember about it is just, oh, dad's in the hospital and decided to grow a beard.
Yep.
And what I didn't know was he grew a beard to be an asshole.
Yep.
Because he didn't want to do anything they told him to do.
Yeah.
And one of the things they told him to do was, you have to clean yourself up, you have to shower, you have to shave, you have to do all of it. So he kept the beard his whole life as a reminder.
It. He was still fighting it while he was in recovery? Or
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. My mom checked him in there, and she took us to the hospital to see him.
That is a bold move.
Right, but I didn't know anything about it because I was like Howard. Six, you know?
Yeah.
And so my whole life, I mean, I remember snippets of my dad as the guy who drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And it is weird. It is a weird thing, but he was a guy who couldn't shut it off. And once in a while, I'll see that image in my head, and I'll look in the mirror, and I'll just go, all right,
worried, yeah.
Like, let's just make sure that, you know, because this is in the family, and my sister has problems with it, and, you know, and so it's like, it's just a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought I have to check in once in a while.
Yeah.
So once I start drinking, I'm just going to have one drink every day.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to stop for a couple weeks and just go, all right, if my hand doesn't start shaking, I'm probably okay.
Yeah.
and by the way, me saying things like that
is
what makes it abundantly clear that I am not a licensed therapist.
The practice you know, of Chris Howard.
If you can quit for a couple of weeks and your hand doesn't shake, you're probably fine.
You're good. Honestly, you know.
Right.
Podcast cured.
Write me letters and tell me, that you're doing my system. Yeah, black coffee, and I quit drinking for 2 weeks.
I think I'm all right.
And you know what? I took a couple of rails, and I think I'm going to be fine.
I didn't shake that bad. Much less than
it
that.
Was the one hand. So, you know, I'm going to give it another day. And I think I'm going to buy a turtle and, you know, maybe see if I can teach it to do some things.
Do you remember those shakes?
Oof. Yeah. Yeah. And that's because I remember them, that's what I'm looking for. I mean, there's nothing scarier than... Because those shakes make it real.
Oh, yeah. I got the cold shakes
and
thought I was cold because it was it was kind of snowing out. But then I sat in the car with the heat on blast for 30 minutes and I was still like convulsing. That was pretty terrifying. And at that point, I hadn't told anybody. That was when I recognized that I needed to do something about it and kind of just like relocated myself out of the situation that I was in. I kind of pulled myself out.
Yeah.
Stopped communicating with everybody except for the closest people to me and stayed out away from my house just so I wasn't alone. And it started happening the first night after a few hours.
Yeah.
Because I was very much, you know, it wasn't even a daily, it was an hourly thing for me.
Yeah.
So as soon as those kicked in, I was kind of confused as to what they were. And then the next day they were there when I woke up. I was terrified.
Yeah.
It was too much to handle all at once.
Yeah. Who was the first person you told that you thought you had a problem?
I told a girl that I was dating. And
how'd that go?
We weren't dating at the time. We had split up a few days before, and my everything was just kind of out of control. I was very much not, you know, I was not behind the wheel of my own life. And I couldn't really handle anything. You know, I was going to work on like a 4-day binge where I hadn't slept yet and just kind of just not communicating to them anymore and disappearing for like a day or two at a time. And then finally when we split up, I waited about a week and I said, hey, I think I need to go to a meeting, and I was hoping that you would come with me because it's terrifying to go to that first meeting.
Yeah.
The first meeting or telling the first person who's going to make you get help, that's what separates people who make it versus the ones who don't, because that's a really scary thing, but you just have to do it, and it never goes bad as long as you pick the people wisely. So I let her in. She said she wouldn't be able to go with me as like a friend, but she was very determined to help myself. So I the first time I went, I pulled up to the meeting, sat in the parking lot for an hour, and then went home because I was there by myself, and that was too much. And then I tried I didn't try again after that. I just kind of, you know, I just let it take over for a couple of like a month. And that was the 7 days a week. I don't have a lot of memory from that month.
Yeah.
The memory loss is absolutely insane. I don't know if you went through that.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. There are some pretty big swaths.
Yeah.
in my history that I don't remember at all.
Absolutely.
And I have friends who a couple of people who stopped talking to me and wouldn't tell me why.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, oh, I did something.
Yep.
Oh.
I've got those.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I mean, that's scary because, yeah, you know, you never want to think that there's this other thing that's lurking inside of you,
yeah,
that decides, you know what, fuck it, I'll take the wheel.
Yeah.
And we'll ride this Sean suit around, mm-hmm, and just destroy everything because it's fun.
Yep. It's funny that you mentioned that because there's the whole debate whether it's disease or personality defect and that whole stigma towards, oh, those are just bad people.
Why can't your personality be a disease?
Yeah. I'm very much of the idea that that is a thing. And when you get into, and I think the majority of it is because when you first get to that point where you get help, there's kind of like a PTSD associated with the things you do remember.
Yeah.
Very much so where, you know, I'll have like manic, like I'll have insane mood swings. I'll get really manic in the moment and I'll like think about something. And once it's in your head for, you know, maybe 10 minutes, but yeah, in 10 minutes you're hyperventilating. You can't stop thinking about it. You're freaking out. Why did I do that? The first thing they tell you when you get in is, you know, you're not in control of yourself. When you let that happen, that's not you. And I've always been of the impression that while some of that rings true, that part is, it's still you.
And to it is a part of you.
The people that you hurt in that, and the people that you, and trust me, I hurt enough people. and I think about it every day. It's a big part of the mental hurdles that I have to take on even like every day when I wake up. And it's just remembering those things that, you know, you kind of, that led up to it, like neglecting people and making bad choices and choosing a drug over a person that you care about, which was everybody in my life, some specific people. And it's very much a thing where that, to them, they don't see it as you weren't in control. That is very much you doing those things to them.
Right. You made a choice,
yes,
to get fucked up and be an asshole.
And choice is the word. Like, you made the choice to do it. Because, and maybe not a lot of people have, and a lot of people do have to deal with it, but there's a big majority that doesn't have to deal with anything like this. They can just handle it. And that's very much their choice if they do something like that and they recognize that. But I've always tried to take it on as, no, that was you. You may have not made the best choices and you wouldn't make those choices under other circumstances, but you have to recognize that's in there.
Yeah.
That's a part of you that's down there that just wants to fuck shit up.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. It you know, I mean, there's a reason that there's the angel and the devil on people's shoulders in the cartoons. I mean, that's just, it's when you start talking to yourself, typically there are voices that answer. So there's always something that's going to answer you when you're asking the universe questions. And if you're asking yourself and you're not in a good place, what the fuck do you know about it? You're not going to give yourself a good answer.
Nope. You never have.
It's like, I've got a solution for this problem. You're not going to like it, but...
or maybe you will.
It'll buy us a couple of days where you don't have to think about anything.
Yep. Oh, God, that self-medication.
What they don't tell you is there's going to be a couple of days after where you really got to think about what you do.
And it's a lot worse.
Yeah.
You can't just let life sit around waiting for you. Yeah. That's very much, and I don't know if you did it. That was the main thing that got me into it was I was going through a huge thing in my life and I wasn't ready to confront it. So mm-hmm. the way I kind of started was it had always been a fun thing to do. But then at this point, I remember the first night I went out
And I was like, I need to do this. I can't think about this right now.
Oh yeah.
That first recognition of like being able to go back and be like, this is the time where this all started, because instead of doing it for fun, I was doing it for a reason at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
That was exactly, you know, I had really just, you know, screwed everything in my life up, and I needed to, and I had been doing it and screwing my life up prior to that. Just it was all a part of it. Whenever I would do it, I couldn't stop, and then I'd finally stop, take a couple weeks off.
Yeah.
But in that, like, you know, 3-day period, I'd be like, who the hell was that? And then I always had to think about that while I was there. And very much before you start talking about it, you're just worried about, you don't know what that is.
Yeah.
That's something you don't talk about. That's like, you know, that's like the brother in the attic with the weird face. Like, we keep him up there and he eats raw steak.
Yeah.
Like, but then once you kind of like recognize that, oh no, all of a sudden I'm sad. And my first thought is I can push this off.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with this for as long as I can afford it.
Yeah, yeah. The case of it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's
fine.
It's all fine. All of this is fine.
The Aerosmith song. That's from Meetings.
Yeah.
The meeting jingle.
So as far as that's concerned, so you get in the program, you've talked to an ex-girlfriend, and you sort of reluctantly start putting this idea together.
Yeah.
That you're going to do something about it.
Uh-huh.
And then afterwards, you're left with this, you know, you've now done the great thing that you're supposed to do, which is get help.
Yep.
And your reward is to be able to sit in this crater that you've made.
I very much associate with that crater. That is my home.
And now you have to start putting all the things you broke back together.
Mm-hmm. You know what they say about, like, the dinner plate? You break the dinner plate on the floor. You try and put it back together, it's never the same.
Yeah, yeah.
You just got to get a new plate. That's the thing.
Right. You know, there is a little bit of sitting there with glue for a while and going,
you put as much
I can make this work.
You put as much of the plate back together as you can. And then, you know,
but after a certain point, I mean, you have to learn to tell yourself,
mm-hmm.
this is a thing I did.
Yep.
It's a thing I can't fix. Mm-hmm. So I have to make peace with it and go buy a new plate.
Yeah. It's very much, you know, say the plate breaks, there's 1,000 pieces. You have to pick and choose which pieces you want. And those pieces for me were, you know, family, a few of my close friends, and music.
Yeah.
And that was all for the first couple weeks, like, that the friend thing was a huge obstacle, because, you know, you make those friends in that scene.
Oh yeah.
Those people don't care about you the way you think they do, because when you go get help, maybe a few will be like, that's great, good for you, man.
Yeah.
And then you don't hear from them ever again, or you don't see them ever again, and, you know, you may not reach out to them, but they're not reaching out to you either.
Yeah.
And you're recognizing, I think I was only around that group because of, you know, this or that. So that the first month is just a train wreck of, it's kind of, you know, the train off the rails, and you hit the brakes, and, you know, the train stops, but all that stuff behind you, all the cars are still coming at you full force.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you stop and you're just hit from behind with, I don't have anybody I thought I did. You know, what I was doing doesn't make me happy anymore. And here I am.
Yeah. When I was 19, I was living with some people in a place. I'm not entirely sure how it all happened, but I was living with a dealer and his friend, and in this lady's attic.
Yeah.
And wow. Like, I sold my drums to buy drugs.
Yep.
And it was great, because they made a water bong out of the bass drum.
Yep. Like,
it was the craziest
That's
thing.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, but, you know, they were potheads are industrious.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, that's, you know.
You need some scotch tape and a little thing of glue.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I was going to do, you know, getting tooted up, was I was going to go outside and maybe, you know, wash the car until the paint came off. But other than that.
I'd smoke about a pack of cigarettes.
Oh, totally. Yeah. You know, you go through two packs of cigarettes, and then you start thinking
thinking, maybe I should have a beer and slow down. And, you know, maybe that'll sober me up a little bit if I have some vodka.
Oh, the beer. Ooh, alcohol at 7 a.m.
Totally. And you think that it's going to be fine.
It'll make it better.
It's going to slow me down.
7 a.m. would roll around and I'd go to the place. There was a restaurant under my apartment that opened at 7. And they served alcohol at 7:30, and the bartender got to know me really well. So I would come in at 7 when they opened and wait till 7:30, and I'd say as soon as it is okay, I would like a drink in front of me.
Yeah.
Because I would do that to try and go to sleep.
Yes.
Because I hadn't slept for a few days, and that was kind of the last day of the last leg of the race. I would go there, I'd down as many beers as I could at 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Beers even, not drinks, beers.
Sure.
Go lay down in bed, and that would get me to bed around 1 p.m., you know?
Yeah.
I'd lay in bed just shaking, finally pass out, wake up at, you know, 2 in the morning, and then generally go out and do it again.
Well, because the what the beer will do in a case like that is – because you could probably find a way to sleep otherwise.
Yeah.
If there wasn't all of this clanging around in your head of your own thoughts starting to tell you who you are.
Yep.
And once you start hearing those things, it makes it difficult to sleep. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily like yourself. You don't like the choices you're making. But if you have a couple of drinks, it makes all of those things sound like... And you can go to bed.
You can, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would... If I ever tried to go to bed without it, I would very much have those moments. And towards the end of it, there's a psychosis that goes in with the
– sure.
Especially – I don't know if it happens with, non-amphetamine things. I think it's pretty standard to everything because it happens with late-stage alcoholism. You start having hallucinations and you become very – it's almost as if you're schizophrenic. You'll start talking to yourself a lot. You're generally alone a lot for those late stages because – And it's a weird thing because not everybody who has a problem alone, but most people with a problem recognize that problem the first time they do it by themselves.
Yes.
It's because you're not 100%. You're not at the party anymore.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this alone? And that was very early on for me, but I didn't recognize it at the time. But then that breeds this thing where I would be doing it and at the same time talking to myself about how horrible I was.
Yeah.
And I would look in the mirror and just, you're such a, you know, all the profanity I could muster.
Sure.
Scream at myself, you know, punch myself in the face and then go out and do a rail.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But there's a different kind of thing with amphetamine people, I think. There's a different sort of breed that's attracted to it, for one.
Mm-hmm.
But it also does have a special hijack that it does with your system. And by the very nature of, you know, putting you on pins and needles in the best way, it also puts you on pins and needles in the worst way.
Yeah.
And when it goes away, all you're left with is the pins and needles and no fun.
Yeah. And the fun progressively... And if you have a problem, go get help.
Absolutely. It's nothing to fuck around with. It really
it's
isn't.
Not at all. I'll laugh all I want, but there's not enough I can say to don't be afraid and take that step. If you even think for a second, maybe I have a problem, there's a good chance there's a problem.
The moment you start wondering if there's a problem, that's your clue. There is a problem.
There's absolutely a problem that first time you think there may be, or even the thought of a problem comes up. Like, do people have problems when they drink for 7 days straight? I don't think I do. You do.
I think most people do. But for me, might just be fine.
It's just what I'm doing.
And if you wait a couple of weeks and you're not...
And you're not shaking. it's very, you know, that whole idea of the pins and needles and then they're gone. You don't have the fun anymore. That fun progressively lasts for fewer and fewer minutes.
Yeah.
And I say minutes as in once you get to that late stage, you can't be up for longer than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And at that point, your body isn't accepting anything else, and you keep trying, and, you know, you're chasing the dragon.
Yeah.
Chasing that magic dragon.
And absolutely.
It's something that I never wanted to ever say.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things that I say now that I never wanted to say. like Pink Cloud and, yeah. and DOC. That dragon, though, once you get to the point where you're in those late stages, you can't get that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what breeds the addiction, is you're constantly trying to get back to where you were the first time you tried that. Because the first time was great, because it just clicked yeah. and it made sense to you. It made sense. You thought, this is right, this feels good, but it never feels that good again. And yeah. the only thing that comes from it in those late stages is this psychopathy or whatever of you in your own head saying, I'm a bad person.
Yeah.
But I need to do this because it will make me feel better. And in turn, it doesn't. It never does.
Well, and getting help is kind of the first step in realizing the hard truth that you can be a thing that you don't want to be.
Yeah, and you have no control.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's, I mean, it's up for debate. I very much feel like I did not have a choice at that point. That was the choice that I had, was when I stopped for a day, I was convulsing, and I basically had a friend, that same friend that I had, who wasn't going to, that being said, she's a wonderful person. She wasn't going to go with me, but she wanted me to get help. And she was the person who convinced me it is all right to tell people that there is a problem, because otherwise you won't make it out of this. You're not going to last very long. And I was very much under the impression for about a year, but for certain a few months, that I just wasn't supposed to live for that long. Yeah. I was the kind of person who was going to burn out young.
Yeah.
And I had come to terms with death at the ripe age of 24. And I just thought, you know, I don't want to stop. I'll die before I stop. And I very much recognize that. And the mm-hmm. first time you OD is kind of like a wake-up call, and you can either take it as, I need to get this under control, or, well, that was pretty bad. And yeah. I took it as, well, that was pretty bad.
I got lucky in that regard. I had I OD'd when I was, I think, 16. Mm-hmm. Again, it's blurry.
Yeah. you don't remember the ODs well.
I know I was living with my parents, mm-hmm. Because I remember what I do remember about it is, I remember I didn't feel good. My chest ached.
Yep.
I woke up on my friend's lawn with her older sister resuscitating me.
Wow.
And she said my heart stopped.
Mm-hmm.
She was screaming at me, just angry. Yeah. She was a nurse.
Oh.
so she's screaming at me and angry because I'm a dumb fucking kid who yeah. OD'd in her front yard. And she takes me home because they tell her where I live.
Uh-huh.
She throws me in my front yard and speeds off. So my dad is a musician.
Pulp Fiction.
So he's out. Oh, totally Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction-esque.
Yeah, I got to stab her three times? So my dad is not home, but it's, you know, 3 a.m. yeah. or whatever. I get into my bedroom somehow. My dad gets home, and he comes in to check on me. He's still completely sober at this point in his yeah. life, by the way. But you know what he's doing for a job? He's a substance abuse counselor.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's so...
So he walks yeah. in the room. I'm practically dead.
Uh-huh.
He gets angry. He shakes me around a lot, throws me back in the bed. I wake up a couple days later, I think.
Yeah.
And my parents are fuming angry. And, of course, I'm grounded from everything in the world. I tell him, I was just tired.
16 is a young age.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm just tired.
From being 16.
Yeah. get off my back.
Mom, get out of my room. This is my math. Space.
So then he comes home from work a couple days later, and my dad was like a Jedi master. He didn't say a whole lot, but when he said something, he'd give you like two sentences and it would make a lot of sense later.
Yeah.
Like advice grenades. And so
that advice shrapnel.
Yeah, exactly. So he walks past my bedroom and he goes, oh, hey, I got this at work today and I thought you'd think it was interesting.
Yeah.
And he hands it to him and he walks away. And I'm looking at this card and it's a list of all the different drugs that there are,
mm-hmm.
and how they work and what they do and what the dangers are.
Yeah.
And once I had that education in front of me,
uh-huh.
I knew, oh, I can do this one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But,
yep.
I mean, because I was going to do it anyway, but I was going to do it safer. Like, there were things that I was, yeah. well, that's what I thought.
Yeah, you think
but
that
I was,
sure.
I was looking at it and going, oh, I don't want to do acid anymore.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, oh my God, it makes your brain bleed? That's uh-huh. a cerebral hemorrhage. Yeah. I don't want that. I don't want to be a glass of orange juice. And, you know, you see that, and then it was like cocaine. Oh, I don't want to do that, mm-hmm. or I don't want to do this. And then it just kind of started weaning me away from things. And then all that was left anymore was booze and marijuana, and I found I didn't like it very much.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I was an uppers
yeah.
guy.
And the uppers... That first, when I got that first, the first thing they do in any program, I think, as far as I'm familiar with, is they basically just teach you about drugs.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that middle school, you know, health class, yeah. but a good one, where the teacher isn't weird.
Yeah.
And he knows what he's talking about. Because, and it's funny, you mentioned that your dad was an abuse counselor, a substance abuse counselor, because... My counselor was like 20 some years sober.
Yeah.
And the other two counselors and psychiatrists at the outpatient I was in, one of them was 60 years sober. Another one was 40 years sober.
Oh, Jesus.
Everybody who was – a lot of people involved in substance abuse as far as like the counselor side or the psychotherapy side and all the psychiatry practices are ex-users because once you get to that point, you recognize that a lot of the people that you were around have the same problem as you and they don't recognize it yet.
Yeah.
And you want to help them, but they're not accepting to it. A lot of those people take that and they decide that that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And it's very much a thing where, you know, God, like a part of the 12 steps is helping, you know, helping those, putting yourself first, but, you know, You take a moment of silence for the people who are still out using
yeah.
at the end of every meeting. And those are the people that you're trying to help. Those people who go into substance abuse are generally those people who were abusing substances for a very long time.
Yeah. And I don't have any kind of active God in place yeah. in my life. but I'm also a person who didn't really get their shit together until I could recognize that whatever that means to you, you are weaker than whatever higher power is above you.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases, it's your own weaknesses. Mm-hmm. I mean, you are just a fallible person who is not strong enough to be able to do all of this on your own and manage all of it on your own.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of give yourself over to the idea
mm-hmm.
that there are things bigger than me at play here.
Yeah.
And I like to think that at least the way that it worked for me was you're not smarter than your addiction.
No.
You're not yeah. smarter than your depression. You're not smarter than these things. It's not a thing that you can outthink and outpace.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to sit with it, stare it in the face, and live through it.
Yeah, and higher power is a funny word. A lot of people are barred out of 12-step programs and, you know, AA, CA, NA.
Yeah.
Because there are so many of them that are non-secular, you know. They're all...
Just about all of them have a religious element, but mm-hmm. I think that
it's more.
I mean, it is
the
there for a reason.
But a few of them, and there's a few good ones in Denver. And I don't go religiously to any of them. I generally go to pick up chips because for me, it's very much a thing where I, instead of going to those meetings, will come and play music 5 or 6 nights a week.
Yeah,
because that I get more out of it. I'm in a safe place. I'm by myself. I don't really let anybody come over and kind of listen in. But that element of a higher power for me was a lot of the reason because they require you to go to classes or meetings through most programs. And I would not go to a meeting until around the last week. But there's a few websites you can go on because there are a couple of, you know, non-affiliated meetings, and they use that term higher power.
Yeah.
And they let you associate higher power with whatever you want. Whereas, yeah. you know, the ones that are based in Catholicism, the higher power is sure. God, or, yeah, you know, yeah. there are some that are really weird, and they're like, the higher power is the universe, man.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But I do
I mean, associate. the original AA 12-step book, I mean, it's very dense. There's the a lot of good stuff. Yeah.
It is the Bible,
essentially. It really is. There's a lot of good stuff in it, but it is a program that it loses a lot of people. It tells you there's one way. Instead of saying there are a number of approaches and you need to figure out which one is going to work, but you have to recognize it's a thing you can't do on your own.
Yeah. Have you read the big book, the 12-step book?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The part of it that kind of...
Yeah, the first time I flipped through it, I was like, this is bullshit.
The first time I flipped through it was the furthest I got through it, because there was a part of it that really pissed me off, because I was reading one that was very much affiliated with Christianity, and it goes, I can't remember which step it is, but there's one that says, you know, without God, we are helpless.
Yeah.
And to me, that basically meant, well, I'm screwed. I'm not going to be able to do this.
Yeah.
Without, it's essentially the long of the short is, you know, it doesn't do you any good to try and get help on your own if you don't accept that God is in control.
Yeah.
And for me, that was very much something that barred me from going to those meetings. So I was like, these people aren't going to respect that I'm doing this for myself on my own accord. And me coming here is very much me actively trying to stop myself.
Sure.
And I don't like that aspect of a higher power, in that this is a hard thing to do. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. And I don't want to give that credit away.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's something that I own, and it's something that not a lot of people can do. So being able to say, oh, I'm such and such months, years sober, is something that I want to be like, I am, and I did this for myself.
Right. I think that programs like that are really good for a certain kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's excellent that it's not the only game in town anymore.
Yeah.
Because there has to be other options for people who go, yeah, this just isn't going to work for me.
Uh-huh.
Because otherwise, you're just shutting the door on a whole group of people who need help.
Absolutely. Yeah. And jumping back, you know, to the mental health side of it, there's, with those meetings, a term comes up all the time, and it's pink, like the pink cloud.
So I'm not familiar with the pink cloud. Tell me about the pink cloud.
It sounds really lovely, but in reality, it's crushing. it is.
I knew it.
Yeah, it's too good to be true. The pink cloud is, so once you reach a certain point in your sobriety, the first few months, you know, after going through withdrawals is kind of, it's not smooth sailing. It is very hard. It's not an easy thing. It's not the easiest part. There is no easy part to it, but it is the part where you're the most determined and you're saying, look what I can do. The pink cloud is that point where you come to the realization, this is just life now.
Yeah.
This is just me. And you can't, and that's when a lot of people will go back out, is they'll hit that point. It's, you lose that, you know, that pink cloud, that feeling that everything is going to be great. And all of a sudden you realize, oh no, all of these mental defects I've either put on myself or I've had are still going to be there.
Yeah.
They're not going away because I stopped. And
right.
you lose that determination, and maybe not determination, but, you know, for me, I'm very much at a point in my sobriety where I don't consciously think of sobriety every day, and I have to catch myself, because sometimes I'll be thinking about getting a beer and then have to be like, oh no, you don't do that.
Right.
Because it just becomes so normal that...
That's part of your old life.
That's part of your old life. And you almost settle back into... And you don't realize that you're separated from your old life and your new life. But the pink cloud is when you... It's when you lose sight that, you know, this is something you're doing for yourself. All of a sudden, it is very much just something that you are. And it's something that you don't think about anymore. And you kind of... It comes with a very heavy... you know, everything gets heavy. Like, emotionally, everything gets heavy. And you'll have days, I'll have days where I'm walking around on the verge of tears, and I don't know why. There's nothing there. I'm not thinking about anything. It's just, that's how you feel. And especially when they put you, and a lot of programs will put you on a regimen of antidepressant, SSRIs and things like that.
Sure.
And they put me on SSRIs, and those generally take a while to kick in, and the beginning is worse for you. That for most of them, the first month you actually feel a lot worse off than you did before, and you kind of and I still struggle with that sometimes with it. But the overall is for the better. But that pink cloud gets heavy in it, and it feels that's that feeling. It's when nothing can go right, nothing will make it better, and you are all of a sudden in this place where the thing you used to do and you felt like that is no longer an option, and you have to deal with emotions that used to not be an issue because of one thing or another.
Right.
You have to deal with them. They're in front of you, and you just have to sit through them and get through it.
Yeah, because the emotions that you might have felt mm-hmm. when you would have dealt with that in the past, they were blunted and shot off while you were high out of your mind in a hot tub somewhere. Yep. You know, having a great time. Uh-huh. Like, oh yeah, why can't I just have a great time?
All the time.
Yeah, can't I just mm-hmm. do that? But, I mean, you just it's not sustainable for one thing.
Yeah.
But, so let me ask you this. With the advent of, oh, this is what depression is like.
Uh-huh.
So depression isn't a thing that was even a part of your vocabulary up to this point. Like, don't get me wrong. I mean, I understand everybody, you know, indulges in sadness and mm-hmm. understands, you know, when there's a cause and effect, something bad happens, you feel crushed.
Yeah.
Like, there, you know what I mean? Like, every human being experiences those things. But, you know, when the depression kicks in.
Yeah.
It starts delivering you, you know, the crushing feeling that someone has died when nothing happened.
And that's actually, I had to explain this to a few friends, and you'd be surprised, and a lot of people don't talk about it, but when I finally opened up about having a problem, the people that I decided to keep around were the ones who, in return, almost reactionary, were just open with me about things, and I realized, oh, a lot of my friends are on medication for depression. It is not something they're shy about talking to me with or talking to me about. That whole thing with depression for me, I called it situational depression.
Prior. Yeah.
That feeling of something went wrong and I would be crushed. I never recognized it as a mental health issue because I always associated it with that. The only thing that I can think of looking back on it is that when something went wrong, regardless of the scale, I would take it as if the world was ending.
Yeah.
And now it's even more so that, especially being in a vulnerable position where, you know, kind of like my shit's out there. People see it, they know it. And, you know, I kind of like, this is the personality or the persona that I take on now. But back then, you know, my car would die one morning and I would cry and, you know, punch a window out on the car. That's not normal.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
normal people don't do that. People with problems do that. And it was, you know, it's something as simple as, you know, a couple weeks ago, I came down to the studio and I left the studio key at home because I was driving another car and it was on my spare set of keys. I absolutely lost it. I had to call my friend. I was hyperventilating. You go through those thoughts that you went through when you were out. Like, you're an idiot. You can't do anything right. Your memory is fucked up because of what you did to yourself.
Right.
And you just associate it with that. But that whole mental health aspect, like, once you – and you know how they contribute, you know, when you go to those rehab centers, they say a lot of addiction is triggered by something traumatic that happened.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to where the things that were traumatic to me in the grand scheme weren't that bad. The only thing that was very that could be seen as super traumatic was my mom was diagnosed with cancer when I was in high school, and I had to drive her to chemo like once a week.
Yeah.
And even that, for me, I was so disassociated as an 18-year-old that it wasn't that bad at the time for me because I never thought like I was going to lose her, and it kicked in one day because I've been pushing it off. But even then, you know, I don't accredit any of my substance issues to something that happened to me. I attribute them to things that I did to myself while I was getting into that lifestyle, and that's why I continued to do it, because I didn't want to think about the thing I did the month before. Those were my traumatic things. But that depression didn't kick in and very, very seriously until after I took that step into sobriety, because that was when I had been pushing off these emotional and traumatic events for at least 2 years. And I never really had to think about them because whenever I started to, I would ignore it. And then the first, you know, month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, that's the only thing on your mind.
Yeah.
Ever. That's it. So you wake up and the first thing you think is that horrible thing you did on like January 26th, and it won't leave you for hours. And then you just have this gray cloud floating over you for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
And the depression,
it's like the shittiest mutant power ever.
Oh my God.
Because it can manifest later.
Yeah.
Like you've lived your life and there's been maybe a seed somewhere in the back of your consciousness, somewhere in the back of your soul, in the back of your brain. There's this seed that's been lying dormant the entire time. And then suddenly you induce trauma with drugs and alcohol or, you know, severe actions. And then the mutant power kicks in.
Oh, yeah.
And guess what? Now I can feel worse about myself than anyone.
My superpower is I'm sad.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't have to be triggered by anything.
No,
it can come out of nowhere. You can feel like garbage in the middle of something good happening for no reason.
It's kind of like a super, super upset radioactive spider. Like it bites you and it just gives you that upset feeling all the time. And it is funny that you say that, because that seed idea that, you know, it's always been there, but it was not ready to kick in until you really fucked up.
Yes.
And then you do that and then it says, here I am.
Yeah.
I've always been here. I've been waiting for this moment.
Right. Yeah. The depression's ready and you are not.
No, not at all. But you let it in. Some people do it to themselves. I very much did it to myself, and that was a large part of the depression at the beginning, was recognizing I did this to myself and having to come to terms with that. And feeling numb for so long to almost every conceivable emotion was something that I had to say, oh my God, you did this for 2 years. You haven't felt love or affection or sympathy for 2 years of your life that you've wasted, essentially, is the way I see it. You know, those were the years that I lost. And I had good times during them, but they could have been better.
Yeah.
They could have been great. I could have really enjoyed those years, but I was too caught up in my own thing.
How long are you sober now?
4 months.
4 months.
4 months now.
Good for you, buddy.
It was
very hard. I mean, that's really, really hard. A lot of people don't make it that long.
No. Yeah. And I have friends who have gone, the horror stories that you'll hear in these meetings. If anything, if you have a problem, go to a meeting. Or if you don't have a problem and you think that you might, go to this meeting.
Yes.
And you'll know whether or not you have a problem.
Oh, you'll know real fast.
The stories you hear made me think that I may not have a problem.
Yeah.
Like you hear some nightmarish, you know, people live in hell, and it's living, that is a lot of what people call it, is, you know, you're living in hell. You're not in the world anymore. You're in your own world and it is hell. It's all on fire. Mm-hmm. That whole association, it's very much a thing that, you know, the first 4 months, I've been told it gets to the point where people do it where they'll say, I'm going to make it a year, and they hit that year mark and they kind of lose sight of it. They say, I did it for a year.
Yeah.
I can do it again. That's something that I'm very wary of.
Yeah.
Every time you go in to pick up a chip, that's why I still go get them, is because once you pick that up, you recognize, all right, I got to get the next one.
Well, it's a totem.
It's a totem.
As well. Yeah. I mean, it's a physical thing that you can... Right. Yeah, exactly. It's a physical thing that you can put your hands on, you can touch. Yeah. It's a manifestation of an idea.
I carried that totem around for the first 60 days every day. It was in the fifth pocket on my Levi's.
Yeah. And it's a thing you can reach down and you can touch when you get weak or when you start to feel like things are spinning. Mm-hmm. You can touch it and remember. Where you are, what you're doing, and why you're doing it.
I used it for the anxiety, because I would have
I would worry a hole right through that coin.
Yeah.
They make them out of steel. I would actually have severe anxiety attacks if I forgot it. If I left it at home, it became a crutch, because if I left it at home, I would get where I was going and I'd go to grab it to flip it around on my finger while my friends were at the bar and I was sitting at the table. And if I didn't have it, I'd freak out. I would lose it. There's other times I would have anxiety attacks.
Well, especially when your reality feels like it's kind of in flux. I mean, your reality has been one way your entire life up to this point.
It's the inception.
And now,
inception totem.
It's like someone has made you wake up and now, oh, life is different today.
Yeah.
And this is what life is now. I haven't prepared for this.
Yeah.
And so to be able to touch something to bring you back to a reality, so you go, okay, so the sky looks purple and the people around me seem like a problem.
Yeah.
I'm going to touch this thing and I know this thing is real.
Yeah.
Because I remember where I got it. I remember when I got it and I can feel it in my hand. And so I'm going to focus all of my attention in reality on this one thing that I can believe in this moment.
The flip through the fingers. it was the weight. Those coins, some of the ones they give out are very heavy. And
they're very heavy, yeah.
They're very heavy, and I feel like it's on purpose. Because I've gotten the light ones, and the light ones don't do it. The light ones, they don't do it for you the same way.
Well, the heavy ones, I mean, it's no coincidence they carry weight.
Yeah. And they always have something inscribed on it, and generally it's pretty generic and almost always Bible verses.
Sure.
The best one, I got two that really stuck with me, and the first one they gave me, and they gave it to everybody on their first day in, is if nothing it says nothing changes if nothing changes. And it's very much true, because there's so many people out there who want that change, but they're not going to do anything about it. So if you don't make the change, nobody's going to make that change for you. You can't get somebody help. You have to, if you want to beat it, you're going to try and beat it. But if you put, you know, if somebody checks you into rehab, there is a 99% chance the only thing you're thinking about is the day you get out, what you're going to go do. So I was fortunate enough to like snap out of it for long enough to say that I wanted it. And the last one that I got was First Things First, which I thought was very ironic that it was gifted to me on my last day.
Nice.
In the program.
I like that.
And it was because I spent a lot of time worrying about other people, and I was always around other people, and I was always concerned with, you know, I feel like I fell into it to kind of fit in. And I was always thinking about other people and what they thought about me, or whether or not I was having a good time around these other people, if I seemed like I was a cool guy. And that First Things First, the guy who gave it to me, he says, I got you this one because you're first. You're the first thing you have to think of when you wake up. Because if that's not what you're doing, the first thing you're going to think of is, where am I going to get my stuff today?
Yeah.
It's very much, you have to think about yourself before anything else. And it's a very, addiction is a selfish disease. We'll call it disease for this.
Sure.
It's a very selfish disease and state of mind where the only thing you really care about is getting your fix. But then recovery, sobriety is also very selfish. The amount of people you have to leave behind for your own good is very selfish. And the amount of time you have to, you know, you're very vulnerable in the early stages. The amount of time you have to spend saying, I can't be around that person because they're going through something traumatic, and I don't know if I can handle that. I don't know if I can be there for them, and I don't know if I'll be able to come out of that okay.
Well, and I would argue that it's the way to really wrap your head around the idea of addiction as a disease is to think about the fact that the chemicals in your body have been designed to react to outside stimuli with an overreaction of birthday party excitement that nothing else will give you.
Yep.
And then pain, when it goes away, the same way that someone with diabetes can't produce insulin properly.
Yeah.
You know, and so when they eat a lot of bread and they have a problem with it, That's a disease.
Yeah.
When someone has celiac disease, they can't eat bread.
Yeah.
It's a disease. It's your body going, I'm either producing too much of this thing, not enough of this thing. Guess what? Your chemicals are just hosed. Sorry. There's mm-hmm. a thing you can't do. You can't have peanuts.
Yeah.
You know, it's
your body doesn't like them.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's that same kind of thing. So it's not so much like, you know, your disease is that you get to be fun at parties.
Yeah.
It's that your disease is
good
that
disease.
Yeah, it sounds like a good disease
fun.
On the outset,
yep.
But you know, once you start realizing that it comes from a place of your body going, "Oh, guess what? We just found a thing that we're not going to let you sleep until you get more of it."
Yeah. You, so.
Oh,
so,
and you know how other people can just have a little bit of fun? You can't.
Not a little.
Yeah. You have to have all the fun, whether you like it or not.
You get all the cake and 27 candles.
Yeah, exactly. So buckle up, Buttercup, because it's coming in with a funnel.
I don't want to date you, but so when you were in your inpatient, did they give you the whole scientific? You know, there is this one video that they had everybody watch, and there was a guy that I was in with, and he mm-hmm. had been in the same program 7 times, and this was his 7th time going through it. And actually, the day he got out, he went and drank, and he ended up in the detox center 2 days later. But he's very much a lifelong struggling alcoholic. But with the video they have you watch, I can't remember the name of it, but it's so standard. They go through the whole science side of it, and I'll botch it for you for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can't wait. The way exciting stuff here. So the way it works with, you know, any drug is, like I said earlier, my brain doesn't really produce those chemicals that it needs to feel happy, to be okay and just be content with things, because your brain gets rewired. Mm-hmm. After a long enough time, and even that first time, your brain is instantly rewired where, you know, the hierarchy of needs, where it's, you know, shelter, you know, food, water, like relationships, that.
Yeah.
So they did this study, and this is when the whole thing where disease became a word associated with addiction was a thing. They did a study on lab mice, and they gave them cocaine. And they also put food and water in their pen, but they could press this button and get cocaine or press a button and get water. Every single one of the mice died.
Yes.
It sat there pressing the button until it died of starvation because the way your brain gets rewired is the first need is no longer food or water, or I think it's food and water, or maybe.
Yeah. But I mean, how familiar is that?
Yeah.
I mean, just sitting there going, mm-hmm. you know, if you had an unlimited bank account, you know, you'd be that mouse.
You would die.
Just going, I'm fine.
There were days where I didn't have a drink and I didn't have a glass of water for, you know, 3 days. I had a few beers. But, you know, that it's very much a thing where
you just
that,
sit there rubbing your face and feeling your teeth.
Yeah,
and,
it is the first thing you need. And it's the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
You push off those, you know, and the weirdest thing about it is you can never satisfy that need no matter what you do, even
right.
if you're doing it. So you never can make time for the next thing. And that's when you start losing people and losing sight of what's important to you because that is the only thing that matters. And it's very much a thing that – and it's dangerous later on because your brain, it's like a path, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you're trying to essentially scratch an itch with a mirage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you make that – so with your brain, the you know, the connections in there, you make those connections over time. And the longer you do it, it's like a walking path. You know, the more times you walk on it, the more, like, pronounced it is on the ground. Like, you can see it better. It's there. It's a thing. Once you stop, it starts getting covered up with, you know, grass and stuff like that. But realistically, the reason a lot of people go back out is because all you got to do is sweep it off and it's there again.
Yeah.
And that's why it comes back harder the second time or third time for most people. It's just that. That's the reason.
You're just Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's all it is. It's the same exact thing. You're chasing this unattainable thing over and over again and you keep hurting yourself and saying, maybe this time I'll catch it.
Yeah.
But you're doing good now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you talking to somebody as well?
I was for a while. you know, it's a great country that we live in. I can't find a certified counselor that accepts my insurance.
Oh man.
So I very much just kind of.
Well, don't worry. I'll put your social security number in the feed. We'll find someone.
My social security number is. It's something where, you know, I'm supposed to seek help, but the way I see it is, you know, there's a different way for everybody. And
yeah.
I have enough friends who have gone through it, and I still keep in touch with my care center and go to aftercare there. And whether or not I can afford a counselor is beyond me. So I very much make it so that, you know, there are certain friends who it's almost their responsibility and they are very comfortable with it. And I've had that conversation where I say, hey, if I need you, I need you.
Yeah.
And I need you to be there. And if you can't, I get it, but try. And they have to date always been there. And then, you know, it's kind of self-medicating with music and things that I want to do and making it a point to go. Even if I'm, you know, about to fall asleep in the car on the way home from work, I'll stop and get an hour in.
Yeah.
And that's its own therapy, more or less. Yeah.
You want to play a song?
I'm going to play a song from
play me a song.
From a solo project.
Play me a song.
I'm going to play just for you. It's from this solo project that I'm working on called Riches. And it's very much a song that I wrote maybe more or less recently, and it's very relative to the subject of drug addiction.
All right.
What's this called?
It's called Numb. Thumb. Numb. This one's called Numb. It's very much about coming to terms with all the shit that you just so happen to do. Yeah. This is the hard part. I feel I'm coming down. My hands are shaking now. When did this all start? About when I swore I'd quit, I made my mistake again. And I don't even know what love is. But why were you the closest I could get? There's not much to talk about this time. I'm not alright. Alright. I can't feel I'm numb. I can't feel I'm numb. I can't feel I'm numb. But I've got love on my tongue. No second chances. I have made my bed. I've got to lay in it. And I don't even know what love is. But why were you the closest I could get? There's not much to talk about this time. I'm not alright. I'm not alright. I can't feel I'm numb. I can't feel I'm numb. I can't feel I'm numb. I've got love on my tongue. I can't feel I'm numb. I can't feel I'm numb. I can't feel I'm numb. I've got love. I can't feel I'm numb. I can't.
can't feel numb. I can't feel numb. But I've got love on my tongues. I can't feel numb. And I can't feel numb. I can't feel numb. But I've got love on my tongue.
That was beautiful, buddy. Thanks for talking to me, Sean.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. Check out our band at the... No, I'm just kidding. Thank you much.
Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, you can find Sean at DecaturRock.com or richesdenver.bandcamp.com. As a matter of fact, if you like what you're hearing right now, this piece of music, as well as the piece of music that comes in right before each and every one of these conversations, is done by Cakers. So go to Bandcamp and look up Cakers, C-A-K-E-R-S. And that's it for me. Go to randomify.com/store, get yourself a copy of a Suicide Coffee Mug. Get yourself a t-shirt with a cartoon on it. And try to stay out of trouble. Don't kill yourself out there.